Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 101. On this episode of the podcast, we are talking about X-Men Apocalypse. To join me talking about this film will be two new guests to the podcast, Tony Fagan and Aaron White, who is from the Feeling Film podcast. We have an interesting time talking about this movie, Bryan Singer's next foray into the X-Men universe. Bryan Singer is someone who people typically like his X-Men films, but we might have a slight difference of opinion about this one. We go into a lot of that, a lot of the good, and a lot of the things we wish we could see and we have seen from the X-Men franchise. In the meantime, make sure you guys are checking out realworldtheology.com for new reviews, top five lists, streaming recommendations, and all kinds of other really great stuff. Follow us on Twitter at RealWorldTheo. Please join our discussion group on Facebook and look for new episodes on the 1st, 10th, and 20th of the month. You can find us almost everywhere, especially iTunes, where you can leave us five-star reviews. So please do that. We really thank you for it, and we're looking forward to you hopefully enjoying this conversation. In the meantime, we have a really great show for you. So here it is, episode 101, X-Men Apocalypse and God Talk.
Did you notice in the intro with the sorry to interrupt your ing there, Mikey. I'm sorry, that was a big
moment
for you.
How do I drop Tony from this call?
Don't be that guy. but in the intro, you know, like the world's going through like the little tube type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you notice like slowed down where there was a little scene of Christ carrying the cross?
Yeah,
I didn't.
Yeah, it's actually it's immediately followed. Gosh, what is it followed by? There's one other thing, and then the Nazis.
Yes, but I remember like it was showing like different things in history. I caught it that, and then it turned and slowed down. When you see Jesus carrying the cross, and I was like, "Well, that's interesting to put in there."
So I was listening to an interview today with the screenwriter and producer Simon Kinberg, and he actually got a question about that, and it was everything that they slowed down and showed was supposed to be some kind of regime. Or some sort of power in the world. Like it was showing us, it was trying to do snapshots of the things that had taken people's attention and worship in Apocalypse's stead. And Christ was one of those, and then the Nazis were one of those.
Which, I mean, basically the same thing, really.
Oh, totally the same thing, obviously.
Well, actually, yeah. What I really noticed the only thing that I really noticed going through the opening credits of X-Men was I felt like I blinked and suddenly like what is it? 1900 years passed. I was like, did nothing happen between like zero and like 1940? Did the Middle Ages never happen? Did nothing else? I mean, British Imperial, like there wasn't any like pictures of like British imperialism or like subjugating India or the American Revolution or whatever.
Well, these weren't on the same scale as Apocalypse, you know?
I guess. I'd say I want to really have another example besides British imperialism, but I feel like British imperialism and or just imperialism in general, any example of that, French, Portuguese, whatever, I feel like you could probably throw a picture of that in there somewhere. So, you know, just some people giving some disease blankets to some natives in the Caribbean or something like that. Columbus, I think that, you know, the Spanish, you know, I think that's a pretty big deal. The Crusades, anything.
So yeah, the Crusades especially, I think, would have
definitely
been one that they could have easily depicted in just one, you know, graphic, quick little shot.
Well, I guess there's been a lot of reaction to the film in general, and it's been interesting to see people of faith, I don't want to necessarily say Christians exclusively, but people of faith talking about X-Men, because X-Men itself drops a lot of faith words, a lot of Christian words, but like I said, it's more broad than that. A whole bunch of allusions to lots of different religions or systems of belief. And I don't necessarily know it deserved it, not necessarily because of how it treated it, which we can talk about a little bit later, but just because of the quality of film in general. And maybe I'm giving too much away from my personal feelings on this film, but to me, X-Men Apocalypse, it didn't meet my expectations, which I thought were not very high, because, you know, we all just watched Civil War, right? Like everyone's seen Civil War.
I saw it three times.
And we all probably saw Batman v Superman as well, right?
Probably. Oh, yes.
Yep. And so, obviously we've done a podcast on Batman v Superman, and it's known that I didn't really care for that much. We did one on Civil War. Obviously, I cared for that a great much, which is totally a phrase. And I expected this to be in the middle. And, you know, to be fair, I did find it kind of in between my feelings in between those two films. But I'm kind of wondering where it landed for you. So, Tony, I don't even necessarily know. I don't want to frame this question too strongly because I don't want to box you in. But how does X-Men Apocalypse stack up to you, not only as a film, but how does it stack up to kind of the other X-Men films in the series? Or maybe even, like I said, we can stretch this and say, how does it stack up against other films in Fox's Marvel Universe?
I think, they tried too hard to meet the expectations of the concept of having Apocalypse there, because I felt like, especially in comparison to this one, the Days of Future Past was better. Not like the way it was written and the way everything played out. Because mm-hmm. this one, like, it felt like jumbled up in a few parts and a little messier.
Do you think that this film is, I mean, like, I was really trying hard not to do like a let's just all rank them again, because I feel like we've had so many Facebook discussions on like, what did you rank them? But I mean, like, where does this kind of land? Does it land in like the, do you still think even though Days of Future Past is better, which I would agree, do you think this is like still an upper echelon kind of X-Men film, or do you think it came in a little too far below?
Maybe a little too far below.
But not like Last Stand below, but like,
yeah, not that low.
Wolverine Origins.
Yeah, which, I mean, that kind of touches on and just how many people we've had play William Stryker. You know, mm-hmm. Maybe one day they'll get it right.
Well, it's like I like to think of it as the new Batman. You know, you're not really cool as a B level character until you play William Stryker.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Aaron, I'd ask you the same thing. Like, do you think this film succeeds as a film? / how do you think it stacks up against kind of like the other X-Men films?
Well, I did really enjoy it. I've seen it twice now, so I will admit that I came out of my first viewing on a bigger high than I did after my second. My second one kind of came back down to earth a little bit when I realized how messy it was, like Tony was talking about. So the things I really liked, I kind of liked more, and the things I didn't like annoyed me more. So everything got amplified in my second viewing. I would say it's just below the halfway point for me. So I have X2 at the top and Days of Future Past, and those two are really kind of untouchables. But mm-hmm. this one's below the rest of them for me, below the ones that most people like, below First Class. It's below Wolverine, the Wolverine standalone, not mm-hmm. Origins. Yeah, Origins doesn't exist. Yeah, it's
it has to. Yeah. I reviewed it for the site. I had to watch it again.
It's like one of those. It's like that movie where what film is it where things just like literally start. It's Back to the Future, right? It's like Back to the Future. Maybe your review will just start crinkling and disappearing.
What review?
We're going to pretend exactly. So I really liked it. I thought Tony, you said it perfectly, or Mikey, you introduced it perfectly. I'm sorry. When you said that they tried to do too much in a way, and they really, the concept of Apocalypse was such a big idea to try and do, and to try to make it a human story and not this big world shattering, massive earth destruction kind of movie was a big challenge. Mm-hmm. And especially to do it with so many characters, because they had a lot of characters so many storylines that they were trying to work on here, that some of them really worked for me. I mean, the Magneto's arc was fantastic. Jean Grey's arc was pretty great. You know, even Quicksilver's arc has a lot of potential and good, you know, direction. It's got a direction for the future, at least, you know. But then there's other characters that just didn't.
I like that when people describe something like this, when it's so messy. I mean, I don't want to pigeonhole this film, but I do think it's so messy that you have to start like using so many qualifiers, even when you're trying to say something's good. It's like the Quicksilver arc was kind of mostly, I wanted to like it, but then it didn't, but it kind of did, but no, like, oh, that could have been so much better. Like, I really want, more than most movies that I've seen, the X-Men Apocalypse is one of those films where I feel like it would have just taken a couple tweaks to make this a really good film. One of those things is I feel like they tried too hard to introduce to too many characters that they then just kind of said, well, we've introduced them, we don't really have to develop them at all. But Tony, did you really connect with any of the characters, the new characters especially?
Not really. I mean, there was actually like a few characters I guess I knew from like comics and like other like the animated series. Like, you know, you for a minute there you see Jubilee. And you see a Blob and you're like, oh, we have potential with these characters, but yet you never see them do anything. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, that's a letdown. And some of the new characters, like, I mean, Scott, we've seen him before, and it was interesting how they introduced him. And I mean, that was good, but I just didn't really truly feel connected with them.
So is there any of the older characters that you think they developed well?
I feel like they continued well with Beast and Havoc. Or Alex, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And they did good with, like, the death there of Alex.
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoilers. Oh, yeah. So, if you've never listened to Real World Theology before, we'd just like...
It's too late!
It's too late. Oh. Okay, so...
Spoilers everywhere.
Yeah, just it's raining down spoilers like debris from an apocalypse. Basically, it's like Egypt. It's like Egypt right now. Except spoilers are everywhere. Aaron, so I'd ask you the same question. You actually kind of said that you really like some of the characters and how they were portrayed. So, which characters did you think were like more well done? Which characters did you really connect with?
Well, Magneto and Professor X are clearly always going to be at the top of this list, and especially Fassbender, because he's just we almost don't have to talk about him because that's part of the problem is that. this is what you were saying earlier. I've got to qualify.
Yeah.
But Fassbender is so good, and McAvoy really is close, that they out-act the rest of this movie and the rest of this cast. I mean, the cast is decent, but like Fassbender brings... I'm hurting for Fassbender in some of these scenes. Like, mm-hmm. He's like making me want to cry. I'm feeling for him, and it's a connection that no other character is able to ever get close to. And I think that's tough, because then, you know, you see all of these other ones and it's like, well, I want to feel something for them too. And you don't. Jean Grey grew on me a little bit the second time around. I liked her a little better. I didn't care for the character the first time, or the actress. I don't watch Game of Thrones anymore. I've gone through like 3 seasons. I didn't even realize who it was, to be honest, until I went and Googled, hey, who was that Jean Grey character I didn't really love? And I was like, oh, it's her.
See, that's like the whole time I was thinking of, oh, Sansa Stark's here. And so like, that's like, it's one of those things, like you get a character embedded from an actor or an actress, and mm-hmm. you think of them as that character every time.
You're waiting for like Jean Grey's direwolf to show up and save the day?
Pretty much.
Well, I mean, of course not, because her direwolf has been dead for some time now.
Oh, obviously.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, from season one. if you've not started watching Game of Thrones at this point, which... this is where I have to caveat things, which I don't necessarily recommend to most viewers, but if you have, you know, blah, 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 et cetera, pretend I said all that you know we've said on like 100 podcast episodes, you're probably not going to watch Game of Thrones because you've already determined it's really not for you. And you're probably right. If you think it's not for you, it's probably not for you. So
my other one is Jean Grey, though. I think I do enjoy, like I said earlier, her story arc, and she goes through this progression of, you know, introduction with the nightmare, and then we get to see her, you know, making a little bit of jokes with Scott, and then, you know, a little the beginnings of that relationship, and we all know where it goes. There's a cool scene with her and Logan, probably the only decent part of that entire sequence, but we can go there later. And then she just has this progression about her, you know, leading up to where she's understanding more about her power and the fact that she has to be the one to take over when Professor X can't do things. And she's going to become kind of the leader that she eventually will be. And I don't know if you guys did this or not, but I was watching this movie and with everything in mind that we're kind of circling back to X-Men X2. So if you realize that the timeline has been rebooted, like we have to get back to the kind of character progression that we had at that point way back 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, but I'm hoping that in a world where the timeline has been altered, that we can not have to suffer through a Scott Summers, Jean Grey relationship. That doesn't make any sense. One, because it never made sense to me in general. And I mean, I feel like I'm getting an amen on that, right? I'm getting someone testifying on that. But even worse is how it was depicted in this film. And it's what kind of soured me to Jean Grey, besides it seeming like, Sophie Turner kind of struggling with her American accent sometimes. What really got me was the fact that Scott Summers, how he was written in X-Men Apocalypse was totally unappealing to me in any way. I felt no remorse or, just anything for him. I really felt nothing. And Jean Grey is basically ignored by this guy when he can't see her. But then as soon as he can see her, he's very interested in her. And she's kind of okay with that. And I feel like that's a problem. I feel like I'm like, hey, Jean Grey, if you're my daughter, I'm like, if a boy's only interested in you after he can see what you look like, probably not a guy you want to hang around with, because he's kind of a creep.
Yeah, absolutely.
So besides my kind of dislike of how they portrayed that unfortunately budding relationship, I don't know. I feel like Jean Grey had a whole bunch of interesting moments, but I don't feel like she had an interesting arc. It was snippets. And I feel like it was like that with a lot of characters. You know, like Nightcrawler, he had an interesting kind of snippet when we see him get introduced and when he had to use his powers occasionally. You know, we see the same thing with Cyclops. He had like one or two scenes, but it never really developed his character. It just kind of introduced his character. And I would be here for a very long time if I had to talk about how disappointed I was with the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, who are built up and build as some of the strongest mutants on the planet, and we get to see them in action for like maybe 2 or 3 minutes apiece.
I felt they built that up too much. And then when it happened, it was like, okay, here's Magneto. He's doing his thing. You two, you protect me.
thanks, I guess. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, that was probably one of the biggest sins the film had. And especially Magneto is taken completely out of the climax. Completely out of it. I mean, he's the most powerful horseman there. I mean, he's the big bad, really, of the entire series until now. And he spends the entire time floating in a bubble.
Yeah, I mean,
doing nothing.
He did.
Like, just take all the metal from everywhere and bring it here. I'm not going to tell you why. But that's your purpose, even though you're the most powerful guy here.
Well, I mean, he does give some very quizzical looks to Mystique and Quicksilver. I mean, in the way only Michael Fassbender can do. So, what I'd also say about Fassbender and McAvoy is it's tough, and I think, Aaron, this is kind of what you're saying, is they elevated the material they were given, because I feel like if almost anyone else was given what they were given to work with, we'd have been like, I just don't care. And actually, I think most of the other characters were given what they were given to work with, and I didn't really care. But when, you know, Fassbender and McAvoy, who have been these characters for, this is their third movie, they are not only great actors, so that helps. But then having, you know, been the third time they've done it, I feel like they really understand these characters and they really enjoy playing these characters. despite like maybe the simplicity or the fact that it's a superhero movie and it's not supposed to be, you know, deep or whatever. But I feel like they really understand the characters and they really elevated what little substance their characters were given to a height where, you know, you do feel very bad for Eric or, you know, Magneto when he loses things, especially when it seems like he's trying so hard to kind of turn over a new leaf. And yeah, I feel the same way when you know, Professor X is realizing that there's things that he needs to do possibly for the greater good, especially when it comes to his love life or, you know, possible love life. I don't know, you know, don't want to make too many inferences there, but I still feel it as opposed to other characters. I knew, like I said, I knew Scott Summers was supposed to be struggling with his powers, but I felt like he was mostly uninteresting. I felt like, you know, Nightcrawler was a man out of country and culture and obviously looked different. And I never felt like we really struggled with that. We just kind of made like a joke that he didn't know what a mall was. They're just like surfacey things. And I guess I kind of wanted more. But
yeah, one thing that we missed out on that I found out today in this interview was that there is a great John 80s 1980 mall scene montage that took place that had them doing all kinds of 80s stuff at one point. At one point, Nightcrawler even like jumps in and into this like breakdancing that's going on in the mall, and they, you know, they go to an arcade, and there's a whole bunch of stuff there, and it's got Jubilee in it as well. That apparently was really, really fun, but didn't progress the story, so they took it out because of the bad timing. But it's too bad, because I would have liked to seen a little bit more of that. I mean, it was a cool way to introduce it, to say, okay, these guys are still kids, and they're going to go to a mall. That makes sense. But we didn't get to see it. We get to see them coming back laughing, and their house is blown up.
Yeah, it kind of makes you wonder what they did, because we just see them at the movie theater for a second, and so I guess we'll see that deleted scenes maybe or something.
Yeah. I guess that's what I lament about this movie. And that's one of the reasons that I'm trying very hard, especially with as much flack as critics are getting these days for being overly critical. I'm trying very hard not to be overly critical for critical sake, but I think it's films like this that I mentioned earlier that I really lament that it would have taken it feels like so few tweaks to make it such a better film. We may talk about this in a future episode, but I felt very similar to the new Turtles film. Just films that I think are very close to being really good films, but they cut some quick corners. And that's what I think X-Men Apocalypse does with characters. I think it's so interested in introducing you to so many cool mutants that it forgets that we actually need to care about what those mutants personally before we care about what they're doing. Which is, I think, that one of the problems we'll have with the climax of the film we'll get to. But I don't want to necessarily be totally negative, because there are lots of fun parts about this film. So, Tony, when like you left watching this film, what were some of the things that stuck with you, or maybe your like some of your favorite parts, or things that maybe made you really think when you left?
I sat through it, and afterwards it was over. I sat and kind of like tried to take everything in, because I guess I didn't walk away amazed, like Aaron here, but
well, it's kind of his thing, you know.
Yeah,
he's got a reputation. Yeah,
I mean, I liked how they ended it with introducing the danger room and stuff, and that was kind of cool. And you kind of have your, I guess you say, your original mutant X-Men group there with the Mystique as well. But, and I tried sitting there thinking what else I had, I could truly take away, but I didn't think of anything that truly stood out to me in this film.
Mm. Did you have any other parts of the film that you just really enjoyed? Is there anything that would make you want to go see the film again?
Our glimpse of Wolverine was kind of neat.
I'm going to say, I hate when that's the best part.
Yeah, I know.
That might be a problem.
It is.
Big red flag. It's like, wait a minute, the thing that probably shouldn't have been in this film to begin with was probably the best part. So what was it about the Wolverine scene that you did like?
For humor's sake, I thought it was funny whenever he left and they're like, I hope we don't see that guy again. I was like, really, guys?
They basically gave him a similar role to Days of Future Past, but First Class, except they gave him longer to run around and a different tone. Same reaction, still like a punchline, but...
You want a fun comic factoid about that scene?
I do.
When they find him, he's actually wearing a very famous helmet that is... It's bigger and worse in the comics. It actually covers more of his face in the comics, and they couldn't do that because it's Hugh Jackman. If you're going to put him in there for a cameo, you got to be able to see it's Hugh Jackman. But this helmet was used to mind control him, and that's what they used kind of when they would send him out as an assassin to do jobs at the beginning of the Weapon X program. Mm-hmm. But in the actual comic storyline, the person that breaks him out is Winter Soldier.
Huh.
How fun would that have been?
Yeah.
Well, that's what I want. That's what I want more than anything. I want these two universes to cross over so badly.
Maybe in like 20 years.
You think it'll take that long?
Hopefully not.
Gosh, I hope not. Because I love me some Scarlet Witch, and she's got so many great tie-in storylines between X-Men and Avengers that they could use to bring them together.
Oh, but that's the problem now, right? They've already had these characters duplicated.
Two Quicksilvers.
Yeah. You've already got two Scarlet
Maybe
Witches.
Maybe one day we'll get Avengers versus X-Men.
Maybe.
At some point,
the money will be too good, right? And the studio... It's just like Spider-Man. At some point, you know, Sony was like, the money's just too good not to do this. Like, this is the way we're going to get people to come see Spider-Man again.
Yeah, and maybe Fox will eventually do that. They'll say, well, we can make our money back on our own, or we could make $200 million profit if we pair up versus no profit. So, like, profit's better than none, you know?
Well, let's be real. They're probably still making profit. Except unless they're offsetting the money from Fantastic Four, right?
Yeah, that's not where the money's coming from.
So, do you... Well, here's a hypothetical, not necessarily related question, just for fun's sake. Tony, do you think that... Because I guess let me preface this so you know where I'm going with this. Right now, it looks like the only super successful superhero possibly franchise that Fox has is Deadpool. And I think rightfully so, because, again, even though Deadpool is not something that I can necessarily recommend to all audiences, I think it was the most well-done Fox superhero movie that I've ever seen. Because it was exactly what it needed to be. And it made a kajillion dollars. And right now, with the trajectory of the X-Men, is the only real super successful franchise they have. Do you think Fox would give away pieces of their universe, or they would have to give away everything?
I mean, I think they would probably do the pieces concept. Because, I mean, look at... Or kind of like a deal with how Sony did with Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
How they're like, oh yeah, you can have him, but we still get some of the money.
Like, here, let Fantastic Four show up in the next Avengers movie so we can reboot it again.
God.
It seems like you're not really into that. I don't understand why. It's so good.
Yeah, it's the best.
So, Aaron, same thing. Aaron, do you think they would give it piecemeal, or do you think they would have to turn over the keys?
I don't think there's any way they'd give it up at this point.
Any of it?
Not unless it was all. I think if they gave anything up, it would be all of it. And I don't mean give it up like forever, but they would give it up all in pieces. So they would allow the crossovers, I think, to work, but they would never just give up. I don't think they're ever going to just give up the rights to any of these characters straight back to Marvel. I mean, they have too much of a history going, and we're going to go see the X-Men movies.
Yeah.
I mean, regardless of if they make them 50 million doesn't really matter to them. I mean, it matters, but if they could make 400 million if they go to Marvel, but we're still going to go see them. So I see no reason for Fox to
give up anything
to do it. It's only one character with Sony. It's a big difference, in my opinion, when you're dealing with two huge differences.
Yeah. Nope. I think that's fair. That's why, like I said, that's why it's a hypothetical question. I'm curious what the thought process would be like.
And they have the Wolverine franchise as well. And obviously the first one is completely, you know, like doesn't exist. We talked about, but you know, the second one is great. Most people really love the second one. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty excited about the third one.
Yeah.
I love the possibility of X-23 getting in there, and you know, and it's a new, unique female character. They can, I mean, the storylines that they have at their disposal, they can do Old Man Logan. They can do all kinds of really neat stuff, and so they have some forward momentum in their solo lines. And I don't know how you guys feel about Gambit. I think the casting is, I think it has a Ryan Reynolds like chance, honestly.
So you're saying there's a chance?
I believe personally that Channing Tatum is the kind of guy who can pull off a Gambit perfectly, because there are roles that Channing Tatum is great at. I mean, he's fantastic in Magic Mike, but you just have to get him in the right role. And I just love it when actors say, "I want to be this guy." To me, that's a good sign when they're petitioning all over the place to be like, "I want to be this character."
Well, my biggest problem with Gambit, not that we're going to take a long time to talk about Gambit, is, but it's my podcast. I'm kind of entitled. So I love the idea of Channing Tatum playing somebody, because Channing Tatum has really grown on me, because I feel like he understands like what his role is in Hollywood now. Like he thinks it's like he understands who he is and who he's made out to be. And he's had a lot of fun with that. You know, you can watch 22 Jump Street and completely understand that. My problem with him as Gambit is, though I think he has been cast in some great roles, I really don't want to see another Gambit who does not even pretend to have like a Louisianan accent or a Bayou accent.
Yeah, you Tatum's know? Not Tatum is not good at accents. Yeah, if you've seen Hateful Eight.
Yeah. That's kind of my problem. I don't need another Taylor Kitsch in there, you know, being like, "I'm obviously from, you know, Texas. I'm Gambit. Who are you looking for?" I'm like, nope.
That wasn't it.
Yep, that was totally, you know, and I don't even really hate Taylor Kitsch all that much. I just, you know, I was like, "You're not even trying. Come on. Like, give me something. Give me a little bit here." Nothing. Well, but I will switch gears. So we don't talk about Gambit all day, because we could. Because, I mean, who can't talk about Channing Tatum for hours on end?
Do you want to go back to the moments real quick? Because some of the best parts of this, I thought, were the dialogue, the one-liners.
Yeah.
The one-line dialogue. There's just, like, these little great, like you said, it's kind of messy, but there are little scenes sprinkled throughout that are just really fantastic. For example, I liked when Raven comes to the mansion for the first time, and she meets, and Hank meets up with her, and he's like, "What?" He's telling her, he's like, "You're not blue." She says, "You're not blue either." And then you get Nightcrawler like popping in, and he's like, "Hi, I'm blue." And it felt like a comic book panel to me.
Mm-hmm. It did.
Yeah. So there's little ones like that. I liked.
But at what cost, Aaron?
I love that Caliban was in it, or as I like to call it, James Harlaman did not tell us that he got cast in an X-Men movie.
Yeah.
I've actually like put pictures side by side, and it is uncanny.
No, I think when we were watching
it. Pardon the pun.
Yeah, I think when we watched it, I think I leaned over to my wife and I said, "I think at least I know who, you know, James Harlaman's going to dress up as next Halloween or whatever."
He totally should.
So.
And then, you know, the psychic phone call scene for me was pretty hilarious. It was in a kind of bad but good way, because it was such a fun, neat little thing, because Magneto walks away, because over in the corner you see Apocalypse, and he's over here like just making costumes. He's making this armor for Angel, and Magneto like literally steps away to take this, you know.
He's like, "Hold on, guys, I gotta take this."
Right, and he like takes a psychic phone call. But then the second time I watched it, I noticed he's speaking. Like, he's actually speaking out loud. And I'm like, "Why are you talking? He's reading. This is all happening in your head. Why are you actually talking out loud?" And, you know, and then Apocalypse just kind of looks over at him, and he's got this real quizzical look on his face. Like, "What are you doing?" And before he realizes it. And
I thought it took too long for him to notice.
Oh, it took way too long. Well, he was very meticulous costume designing over there. I mean, he was really on top of that.
He was like, "Oh, I'm going to win an Oscar for this one." I'm not sure why he's German, but
I see what you did there, Oscar Isaac. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm gonna win a me for this. Well, see, I can't really talk about that, because that would be one of those things where I'm like, was Oscar Isaac in this? I don't know. Why did we miscast and completely waste one of my favorite actors? I don't know.
I'm with you.
So, well, okay. So now that we've finally come around to talking about Apocalypse in his own movie, I think one of the things that I've seen a lot of discussion on is the fact that there is a lot of what has been called God talk in this film. You know, lots of allusions or very similar lines to biblical language, very, very direct inferences to gods or mistaken gods. And my stance on it kind of reflects something that J.R. Forrester's frequent contributor to the show said in his review. And he said, as it does again and again, the film just shoves a bunch of God talk together and hopes you think it's saying something. So, Tony, what I would ask you is, one, how did the God talk or the allusions or references, like, did they even stick out to you? Did you notice?
A little bit. Like, I jotted that down when I was taking some of my notes and stuff, because I put out, like, he referred to himself as, like, he's like, I've been called Elohim and Ra and all these other names, but now I'm here and stuff. I'm like, kind of just like, oh, here's all these God names I could use. And so it's like he just like threw them out just as like name dropping type thing.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel like they were making, or that Bryan Singer was actually making any kind of statement, or not only Singer, but, you know, our screenwriter, Simon Kinberg, like, do you think they were actually trying to say anything about God or just correlate Apocalypse as a God figure?
I think it was more so correlating rather than saying, hey, this is a parallel to Elohim and Ra and stuff. But more so that they see him as, like, Apocalypse sees himself as these things rather than this is what Elohim or Ra looks like.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks he is these things.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how I saw that scene.
Yeah, which is a little bit disappointing because I want to say that it was Wade who pointed out that there is actually more God talk in this film than a lot of Christian bent films, and it seems like they do nothing with it. But again, this could just be my opinion. So, Aaron, I'll ask you: Do you think that they were maybe saying something or trying to say something?
I think they probably were trying to say something.
what could it have been?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know, and I feel the same way you guys do. I thought it was. What I was talking to somebody about this today at work, and I was saying, this has some of the most God talk that I've ever seen in a movie, and it adds up to nothing. I was trying to think of, like, I could pull theological conversation out of tons of movies that don't talk about God. And here's one that's shoving God talk and biblical references down our throat. And I'm like, I don't know what to say about it theologically, because it doesn't really have one. What I kind of pulled out was, I mean, I pulled out things within the concept of the movie and what Apocalypse, what his thoughts were, the way that his character was designed. But I couldn't find any kind of coherent message from them to the audience, from the filmmakers to the audience. I don't know. I thought that they were really going for an quote unquote Old Testament God of vengeance type of feel with Apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
It felt to me like he and his force horsemen were almost trying to pull a Noah, and, you know, what he really just kind of wants to just wipe out the world and start over and have them worship him again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I don't know. It was almost appealing at times, because he has a quote. He says, "You're all my children and you are lost because you follow blind leaders. No more false gods. I'm here now." But in a way, that almost, like, you could almost attribute that to God, right? You could almost read that as something God would say to us.
Yeah.
You're my children and you're lost. Stop following blind leaders. I'm here. Follow me. But it's Apocalypse saying it, which is very ironic. It was all over the place. Magneto clearly looks toward Apocalypse as if he's the God that has not failed him, because Magneto at one point, one of my favorite scene is definitely the tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the end of it, he's screaming at God, you know, and he's, I forgot what he says, but he's like saying, look, is this what you want from me? Is this what you want me to be? And then Apocalypse shows up. And it's like, okay, well,
I guess it you.
Is. Good yeah. timing.
Yeah, I sent you a boss.
Well, I think that's your overarching point. It goes back to Tony's answer to kind of like, what were you left with when you left, or like when you finished the film, you know, and Tony, you were describing, you were just kind of sitting there being like, you know, like, well, I want to pull something out of that, but what did I see? What was really presented? And when I think about it, for all the God talk, I think it was all the things that I pulled from it were accidental. And I think, Aaron, you hit on one of them there, which was the idea that he, like, puts himself in a position as God, but it's kind of ironic that he does it because he's obviously going to fail. He doesn't even live up to his own standard of what a God is. And so if anything, maybe, and this is me stretching to hope that there is more thought behind it than there was, that maybe, just maybe, that they were trying to point out the fact that people have thought too highly of gods for too long, and even the best ideas of God are still limited in power and still corrupt, or have intentions that are not as great. Maybe like the Old Testament God that, you know, you're talking about, Aaron. But yeah, other than that, I'm like, man, why did we... I mean, the previews sell this as they're going to really hit home some kind of illusion or some kind of very well thought out correlation, especially between like an Old Testament God and Apocalypse. And I just don't think we got it. And that was, again, this is another tweaking issue. I just wish it tweaked a little bit. But one thing that he said that I think unintentionally hit on a truth was when, you know, he plugs himself into the TV and starts seeing all the information in the world, which again, let's not think about how that's actually happening, because that would hurt our souls to try to figure that out. But I love the fact, Aaron, I think you at least touched on this, that he kind of talks about how humanity is following false gods. And he kind of refers to, like, people, since he wasn't around, they start worshiping their own progress as a false god. Do you think that worked at all, Tony? Do you think that this idea that human progress as an idol came through in the film at all? Or do you think it was kind of a throwaway line that we're looking too much into?
I mean, it's possible it's looking too much into, because, I mean, he mentions that, and then because Storm's just kicked back, like, what are you doing? And he mentions that, and while he's looking into the TV learning, supposedly, it shows all the progress and all the things that we've been through throughout history. So I think it could be more than just like something to throw out. It could be something to kind of take away.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of where what we are hopefully doing on the podcast and at Real World in general, it kind of helps, because I think it ended up being a throwaway line. But I think if we really think about it, it was one of the few things that stuck with me, because I think that, like I said, he's right. I think it would have been an amazing critique for the filmmakers to make, to say people really are full of themselves. They, if you look around at culture, it's all, you know, be yourself, be the best you can be. You do you, you know, that's the ultimate thing that you can go for. Just that's where you'll find happiness. Look inward. And the only, a tweaking thing. I just wanted them to go with that. But then it seems like the conclusion of the film contradicts that, because the end of the film says, don't look to a god, look to yourself. You know, and look to your teammates, like look to human progress, I guess. Look to your accomplishments and what you can accomplish because you'll overcome, you know, old gods, I guess.
Well, that's the only real lesson that I pulled out of it. It kind of ties into that. Mm-hmm. And that was like the opposing themes of Apocalypse. Is he's presenting this message that the strong will rise and the weak will perish. The weak will just get out of the way, right? if you're not strong enough, get out of my way.
Yeah,
I'm coming through. And then Charles has an opposite type of worldview of, and this has always been the worldview of the X-Men, which is that we're the strong and we need to protect everyone. So his view of strength is we need to use it to do good and to protect, whereas Apocalypse's is we need to, you know, kill, steal, and destroy. And it's funny because Christians are neither one. So we're really not called to necessarily be the only ones to protect the weak, because mm-hmm. that's what Jesus is, who we need. We're the weak. You know what I mean? And so in a way, if the X-Men represented Jesus as protecting the weak, then it would have a good message. but unfortunately,
you're telling me they're not going to make that film, Aaron?
No, I guess not. But unfortunately, they're putting it in the, you know, it's put on the X-Men. So we could loosely take a lesson out of that as the X-Men are right, and you know, the weak should be protecting each other. But ultimately, we can't do it fully. You know, we can only do so much, because we don't have that kind of power. Mm. We're not God, and we are the ones that need saving.
Well, I think what that kind of hits on the tail end of is something that should have been explored through Magneto's arc, because I think X-Men Apocalypse shines whenever it focuses on a character and we get to stay with him for any amount of time, because ultimately I think the reason that X-Men stand apart from the other like superhero films is you look at the Marvel Cinematic Universe over at Disney, and to really understand, outside of a couple examples, maybe with like Hawkeye or Black Widow, who don't have their own standalone films, and get a little more development in the Avenger films, like we have to have a standalone film to really come to care about any of the Avengers. The X-Men historically have made us really care about all of the X-Men individually and as a team, and had them all in the same movie, which I think is a very difficult thing to do. But in Apocalypse, we only get kind of what seems like a half-hearted effort. And we, you know, I don't want to retread this. We did talk about this a lot earlier when we were talking about characters and character development. But Magneto specifically seems like he's wrestling with the problem of evil. And the problem of evil is an incredibly nuanced and complicated question for Christians and non-Christians, you know, for anybody of any faith to wrestle with evil and give people a satisfactory answer, especially people who are directly dealing with evil or the problem of pain. And I really wanted there to be an exploration after Magneto lost his family. And it seemed, yeah. And it seemed like the answer was, that stinks. Here's somebody who can give you power. Don't really ask God why. Here's another, like you just, yeah. it kind of trailed through and hit on a whole bunch of points, but never really a straight line to a source. Tony,
kind of like a ref response there.
Yeah. I was going to say, Tony, do you think that, we spent enough time with Magneto, or like, do you at least, can you agree that maybe that they really should have explored the problem of evil with him a little bit more instead of just taking him to Auschwitz?
I feel like they could have explored it a little bit more, because I mean, you see his like kind of like remorse for what happened in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And, cause I mean, he's like trying to turn away, become a new person. He tells his wife that he's like become a new person, everything. He tells that to those officers. He's like, hey, I'm different now, don't do that. But and it's like he's trying to turn away from it, but then as soon as like tragedy hits, he goes back to those ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty familiar, right? That's basically every Christian story, right?
Exactly.
Mm. So the best thing we can learn from his story is that stinks, but that's what we do, so don't do it anymore.
Yeah, and I don't think that he ever reaches true repentance though. And that's another thing you can pull out of it is that, you know, we do see him feeling sorry for himself and we do see him showing remorse, but he thinks that he can just cover it all up, bury it deep inside. He's burying all that sin and he's not dealing with it. He's not actually truly repenting of that and owning it. You know, he's hiding from it. And burying it and trying not to deal with it. And of course that never turns out good for us either.
Yeah. Well, and then we see at the end where he's talking to Charles after they rebuild the mansion, it's like he and Charles have that typical conversation they have where Charles is like, "Hey, we're here for better purpose." And then Eric just kind of wanders back off. It's like, he's going to go wander the earth.
Yes.
And hope maybe he might find repentance, but we know he won't.
I think that's the most frustrating thing, because when we spent time with Magneto and his family, you know, I'm going to drill this in. Like, you're not going to have listened to this episode and not understand how I feel about this. I am with him in his struggle. And when he turns up and basically screams to, we assume, God, maybe as like a Jewish faith that he has, we can maybe assume,
most likely.
Yeah, I mean, most likely. And saying, you know, like, is this kind of what you've, you know, this is what you want from me? He's asking those questions. And I just feel like he's asking questions that we could explore answers. I mean, I don't need X-Men Apocalypse to try to figure out the problem, like I said, the problem of pain. You know, I don't need X-Men Apocalypse to try to give me some kind of essay answer on how we deal with evil in the world and injustice. But let's let him wrestle with it for a little while. Not just flip a switch and be like, oh, well, I was mad at God, I guess. Because I apparently have some type of faith now. And this is something, again, I don't want to like not give credit to JR and his review for. You know, we kind of see this character who we didn't really think had a faith. Or if he did, it was a really weird faith, because he didn't really have a problem killing people. Or doing, you know, things that were things that you would assume people of faith would not do.
Well, it was a fake faith. I mean, it was the same faith that millions of people on this earth have right now. This idea that, well, I'm being good, so I have faith right now. I mean, there's a God, but I don't actually have to change and be a different person. I don't have to completely walk a different life. I can believe. So that's all that matters. And that's a lie. Like, it's not just about belief. Dang. It's about action.
Oh, y'all got called out by Aaron. You can tweet your anger at Aaron at AaronWhiteHatesYou.org. I don't know.
But it's that, and then like the concept of like, I'm a good person, I believe in this, and I'm gonna do good things. And so, hey, I'm fine. That's what it seems like it's connecting with there.
And so it turns around. Is it the classic, or what I think I'm hearing described from you two guys is the classic Christian example of God becomes like the emergency phone, like the bat phone or whatever. Like, you really don't ever need to pick it up unless something's going wrong. Other than that, you're doing a pretty good job, right? You're being nice to people, as nice as you can be. You're being generous in your own way. And so you should be treated pretty well, but when something goes bad, you're like, God, I really need you. You need to fix this problem. You know, the sports ball team needs to win this game. It's really important, or I'm gonna, bad things happen, you know, like incoherent kind of not understanding how an actual faith walk looks.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And I'm pretty sure that these guys are atheists. I probably shouldn't say that because I can't confirm that, but I swear
tweet,
I've heard
tweet,
that.
Tweet your hate at Aaron Witte.
So quick to judge.
Yeah, no, gosh.
But I'm almost positive that I've read that, and it would make a lot of sense. mm-hmm. if that's the case, because it's not an understanding of what our relationship with our God really is. From an outsider, it's just us believing in something. They don't understand it as a relationship.
Well, I do feel like it seems pretty indicting of religion in general. You know, from the thing that we talked about at the very beginning, the even being able to correlate influential things and saying that Christ and the Nazis have the same type of impact on the world. Like I said, not that he's necessarily saying that Christians are Nazis, but not understanding the difference in impact or great impact on the world. To the fact that we have a Magneto who seems to have a undeveloped faith, or faith so easily skewed, so Apocalypse shows up and can be like, oh, I was God, I was asleep, but we're gonna fix it now. I'm not sure why Apocalypse in that retelling kind of almost sounded like Christopher Walken, but I don't really think that at the end of the day they were saying much more than you can't really trust anything, even if it has good intentions or it's good to some people. It's really about humanity. You gotta work as a team. You gotta look to your friends, and you gotta hold each other's arms and hope someone can turn into a phoenix and destroy the bad guy. And then everything will be better. Not perfect, but better. Like, we can eradicate evil, I think, if we just try hard enough. We can eradicate evil gods who want to do evil things if we just work as, like I said, we just use a little teamwork, use a little love, use a little understanding, be the best bees, best us's we can be. And it seems so empty. And it made me sad. And I end my rant.
Now, I to touch on one thing you mentioned there, Mikey, I thought it was funny to an extent when Magneto was like questioning Apocalypse, mm-hmm. and then he was talking about like all these things happening, and Magneto was like, where are you? And he was like, I was asleep.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, if you're a god, why were you sleeping for that long?
I kind of feel like deal. I feel like that's one of those screenwriter lines where they're like, this is a great line. I feel like it's total indictment of like, where is God? He's just sleeping. Seems like a God thing to do.
Yeah, if anything, that's another big negative hit on us, you know?
I mean, not quite as bad as basically accusing people that they don't believe in God. Again, send your hate tweets to @AaronWiche. I feel like we've covered all the ground that this movie would give us without stretching it more than it really deserves. So I wanted to kind of end on a positive, and there were things that made this film very entertaining. So unfortunately, I think we've had to spend most of our time talking about the things that we saw a little more critically and didn't sit right with us. And I keep using the phrase things that I wanted to tweak, but like I said, there were entertaining things about this film. It wasn't completely throwaway. So Tony, what was just a thing or two, like I said, that you really, what scene or two did you really enjoy?
Before we jump in this, I was going to mention, I guess this could relate to it. I thought it was interesting. There was like a theme of family throughout it, where, when Magneto or Apocalypse looked at Magneto and said, you're betraying me. And he was like, no, I betrayed them. And then earlier, Mystique was like, hey, we're doing this because of family. Mm-hmm. And so it did talk about like unity and stuff like that. So that was kind of cool. And I thought I did like that, kept mentioning that.
Yeah.
And then except for the part where Quicksilver like had this moment where he could be like, hey, I'm your son. But then he's like, no, that's a bad idea.
Because reasons.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's one thing I had. So when I left the theater, I wrote down like, oh, family. But then I realized two things. One, every X-Men film has a theme of family.
Yeah.
It's like trying to watch like a Joss Whedon film and being like, oh, there's a theme of found family in this. What a shocker. I feel like every X-Men film hits on that, and some do it a lot better, and most have done it a lot better than this one. And two, I think that's the kind of the twist to it. I wanted this film to hit the family home run, and Quicksilver
had that moment, but
yeah, he had it. And I think if he does that when he has the chance, it brings something new to the table, because all Mystique does in the final scene, or in the closing scenes with Magneto, is tell Magneto a whole bunch of stuff, the same stuff that, you know, Professor X has been telling him for 7 movies now, and somehow it suddenly changes his mind, and it just doesn't make sense. I think he needed something else.
What's funny is that the writer in that interview I listened to specifically said that that scene was written with Quicksilver speaking it, and they took it out and put it into Mystique's mouth because they wanted her arc. It was all about Mystique and her character development was how they wanted that to come out. And they wanted it because of her history with Magneto. They wanted her to be the one to be saying it because they thought it would be more impactful. And so it's funny because you're saying you think it would have been much more impactful had it come out of Quicksilver's mouth.
Yeah, I just don't understand. Well, I don't understand why we spent so much of the film talking about Quicksilver and Magneto if we weren't going to use that. I just, like I said, I don't...
Because he kept mentioning, he's like, I'm trying to find my dad.
Yeah.
I want to go tell him. I want to meet him type thing. But then he's like, oh, never mind.
Well, like I said, it's about character motivations. Like, so for a character to be true, Magneto made a conscious decision to join Apocalypse, and it was determined that he was doing the right thing. Okay, that's great. I mean, he got there pretty quickly. He jumped on board with Apocalypse God quicker than I'd like. So for him to jump back, I feel like somebody would have to bring some new evidence to the table. Because again, for 7 movies, he's been told the same thing. You know, like there's something bigger out there. It's not just about the pain that you have, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so suddenly Mystique says it, and he's like, oh, yeah, okay. But that doesn't make sense to me. It makes sense to me for someone to say, I know we've told you that there are things worth saving in this world. And we keep giving you either metaphorical or allegorical or hypothetical examples of, or even symbolic examples of what that means. But we are never really giving you anything tangible. We're saying for the future, for mutant kind, for those you love. But you're not really putting, you know, wheels to the pavement on that. They had a chance to make that a tangible decision for Magneto by saying, hey, you think you have nothing left, and instead of the future of mutant kind or the world or things or your friends, this is your son. Look at him and understand that the world is not as bad as you think it is. And they didn't do that.
Yeah, I agree. And it was one of the mm-hmm. biggest poor decisions, I thought. And it set up so perfectly with him losing a child. Yeah. I mean, you could not have set it up better.
Mm-hmm. That would have been great motivation there.
Yeah.
It would have been an emotional moment, too. It would have been another one of those heartstrings. Okay, I can feel for these characters now. I can feel for them again.
I mean, think about what that would have done if Quicksilver would have told him. Magneto would have tried to brush it off, being like, no, you can't be, like, I don't care. But then when Apocalypse breaks Quicksilver's leg, Magneto sees that and goes Magneto. Like, that right there to me is like the, you know, it's like, you know, you say like, oh, I don't care about you or whatever. Yeah, I'm going to fight with my friend and I say hurtful things to you. Or even better, I remember growing up, like, me and my brother hardly ever got along after a certain age. And we would fight, and I would say awful, nasty things that I can't say on this podcast to him. And he would do the exact same thing right back to me. But if anyone else picked on my brother, that was not cool. Like, for all the things, for how stupid I said he was and how much I hated him and all this stuff, if anyone, I would step in and be like, listen, that is my brother. And I'm going to do something about it. we know, which was out of character for many reasons. And I feel like that's the moment that we could have had, between Apocalypse, Quicksilver, and Magneto. And like I said, it would have given us something tangible to turn on. So, yeah, does that cover it, Tony?
Yeah, I guess that covers the family concept. Good job, Mikey.
Well, so you're saying also that, the idea of family was kind of, one of the things that you did enjoy about the film though.
I did. Yeah. And one thing, like two things I'll point out here. I was going to mention this earlier when we were talking about like, him as like God, or Magneto was like a, not Magneto, Apocalypse as a God, is he references the Tower of Babel. I don't know if y'all caught that or y'all stood out, but he,
yeah,
was
he
like,
says,
yeah,
shoot your arrow from the top of
slings, or you'll, like, I just had the quote here a second ago. He's like, no more spears, no more swords, no more sling. You can fire your arrows from the Tower of Babel, but you can never strike God. I thought it was an interesting line to put in there when they're doing the nuclear warheads into space. It was just like interesting placement, kind of, because it's like they're trying to like use references, but yet at the same time, like, not rely too heavily or go too deep as far,
yeah,
as those went.
Definitely was surface level referencing. I mean, it was,
that's all it was.
It really felt like that was all it was.
Same thing with like the God name dropping.
Yeah.
And another thing I noticed, I don't know if y'all caught this, but with Jennifer Lawrence playing Mystique as well as Katniss Everdeen, I felt like that was kind of how her role was in this movie, same as it was in Mockingjay, because they're like, oh, she's the hero of this rebellion.
Yep, she's the reluctant hero. Yep.
She didn't want to be this hero, but she is. We all look up to her. And it's like, once she turned blue, everyone's like, oh, there she is, there she is. And then when they're on the plane riding to go to they were leaving the Stryker facility, and she was talking to, like, Jean Grey, and it was, like, similar. I felt like I had, like, similar speech from Mockingjay was going on in this plane.
Well, that might be why I not only thought that by the end of the Hunger Games films, Jennifer Lawrence just kind of looked bored with her character. It seemed like maybe why she was doubly bored with the Mystique character when I watched her. Actually, yeah. there's a whole bunch of critiques I have about this film. Again, try not to be too negative about it, but there's a Slash Film article that kind of lists them, and I was like, oh, it put words to the things that didn't sit right with me. So I'll probably link that in the show notes instead of boring you guys to tears, especially those of you who really enjoyed the film. I'll let that be a conscious choice. Aaron, do you have any final thoughts?
If we're talking about stuff we like that we haven't mentioned, Apocalypse's powers for the most part were pretty darn awesome. Anytime he did the matter manipulation,
or
I thought it was
his powers were.
I mean, this one he used several times, so it was pretty clear. But like specifically the scene with Magneto's coworkers, where he just, I mean, just nonchalantly just drops them into the ground.
Yeah.
Him, and then when he makes, you know, the walls eat people, it just,
yeah,
that power was really cool. I liked a lot the fact that the mutants all have different powers. Sometimes in Civil War and some of the Marvel movies, when we get a lot of people and a lot of characters together, it feels like everybody's kind of the same. Everybody's kind of just mashing and punching. Mm-hmm. But here, everybody has a very unique role. And so even though the CGI didn't hold up as fantastic in this film, it's neat that they all do have unique abilities that somewhat can be shown. And I like the 80s references. I like I think they got the tone of an 80s X-Men right. There was definitely things I enjoyed. Somehow overall, I mean, despite all of the things that I can critique on it, like I said, I still had fun watching it. I definitely don't think that it's one that I'm going to revisit as much as I would want to revisit others.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't terrible. I like the fact that there's life and death stakes beyond the fact that it's just the whole world's life and death at stake as well. But, you know, we lost Havoc on the good side and we lost Angel on the bad side. So there was consequences that were life altering, you know, essentially for each side and each team. And that brought a little bit of a depth to it that I don't think we always see in other superhero films.
But it's funny, when you mentioned like losing Angel and stuff, I want to mention something that I may not have mentioned, and it's about caring about the characters and the character development. Obviously, I did mention that. I remember in Days of Future Past, I actually cared more about losing, was it Wasp or something? Who was the one with the wings?
They called her Angel as well.
Oh, did they? Okay. When they had like one of her wings, and Magneto saw that wing and realized like how many of those people had died. I actually cared more about those characters because of the development from First Class than I did when Angel died. I was like, oh, Angel died, I guess. Okay, whatever. So stakes, yeah, but oh. Did I mention I was trying not to criticize this film so much?
You're doing a bang up job.
I'm doing such a great job. So thanks for listening to the Anti Fill-In Film Podcast. Now, so X-Men Apocalypse, look, I think it was a very flawed film, but it did have small bits of entertainment. It's definitely not a waste of your time, but kind of like Aaron mentioned, you know, I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of people really itching to retread this story after having seen it once. So, I'm not really looking forward to the next installment of X-Men, but again, something that Aaron mentioned, we're all going to go see the next X-Men. I'm not really, like I said, not really looking forward to it, but I know I'm going to watch it, so it doesn't really matter. The one way they would get me excited to see X-Men is if any of the X-Men were in a Deadpool film at this point. So,
yes, let's again, cross them over.
Yeah, again, Deadpool, can't recommend it, but I still think it's the best thing Fox has going right now, until we see what they do with the next Wolverine film. So, as usual, a very fun, a very engaging conversation, and that happens because we have cool guests. So, Tony, can you tell people how they can get a hold of you and follow anything that you have going on around the worldwide webs?
Yeah, you can. My Twitter is at the Tony Fagan, spell it however you want to. There's only one way to find it. I haven't written in a while, but if you go to theologywithinfilm.wordpress, you might find some stuff I write.
You might, like, you might not.
Yeah, you will. It's just old stuff because I need to go back and start writing again. I've just been so busy with grad school.
Oh, the old grad school excuse. Oh, I write 12 papers a week. I don't have time to write a review. I respect that. Well, so follow. You said at the Tony Fagan?
Yes.
All right, cool. Aaron, how can people find you or what you're doing?
All over the internet as Aaron L. White, AaronElWhite. And I have a podcast called Feel and Film. Mikey alluded to it earlier. That really was born out of the idea of just staying positive and talking about film in a positive light, even when we don't have a lot to talk about. Which this is actually a great challenge. This is a film that is kind of right up our alley. But we try to stick to like an Ephesians 4:29 kind of methodology where, you know, we just want to be uplifting and find the best that we can. And you can follow that show at Feelin' Film. There's a Facebook page, Facebook group, all that good stuff, iTunes. But, yep. Hey, Mikey, I feel gypped.
Do you?
Yeah. Wow. I want to do my come on, man moment.
Oh, man. I've kind of played around. I mean, we've hit 100 episodes, so I was trying to play around the format again. It seemed like a little too routine just to do a favorite and come on moment. I feel like we got through most of those moments. Wasn't the come on moment when this film started and then your other come on moment when it ended?
It was, but I saved one.
Okay, go for it.
So my come on man moment is the fact that I love Psylocke as a character.
Uh-huh.
And Olivia Munn reached out to get this character's role. And I just, it broke my heart to see her so wasted and to see that character so wasted. Apocalypse, when he takes Angel and Storm, he puts more clothes on them. He puts armor on them. And he takes hers away. Yes. and he marks up their faces, but she gets a ponytail. Like, it's crazy. It's the exact opposite of what happens to the other two.
But it's like a battle ponytail.
She's hot, yes, but like that's the point, right? It was frustrating that they shoehorned her in there, and then she had just one of the most awful CGI scenes in the world when she's flying through the air, coming
the car cutting scene.
Yes, the one from the trailer, and I don't know. My daughter is 13, and she loves Psylocke, the character, as well, and so I was really hoping we were going to get something special that she could be like, look at this awesome, amazing, hardcore female X-Men, you know, tearing stuff up, and that's not what
happened. Nada.
Yeah.
No, so. That's funny, because I had a really fun conversation with my buddy Mark after he'd finally seen the film, and we talked about how lots of the... not direct promotion, not necessarily the trailers and stuff, but lots of the, oh man, did you know Olivia Munn was doing this and this and this? Lots of it was about how awesome her sword play was and how she learned how to do all the sword fighting. Lots of it was how she was courted to be Deadpool's girlfriend, but she turned it down so she could be a strong female character. And like, there's all these stories before the X-Men came out, and I'm like, wow, they're really playing up Psylocke. And we were both like, what happened? We were like, weren't we going to get Psylocke as like a total, like hardcore, you know, built up piece of this film? And she was barely in it. And when she was, I had no idea why.
And for her to be one of the four horsemen, I feel like she wasn't really as essential or powerful as the other ones were.
Yeah. Well, see, that leads to a true come on moment, which is like Apocalypse declaring, for my four horsemen, basically, I'm going to find the best mutants. And he goes, the first four people I run into, you guys are my four horsemen.
Exactly.
exactly. Yeah.
So anyway, well, I hope you guys have really enjoyed the conversation. I hope you guys have enjoyed the conversation at least as much as you enjoyed X-Men Apocalypse. but you can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. As always, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you've enjoyed it. Heck, subscribe to the podcast if you did enjoy it. Surely there's an episode in there somewhere that's right up your alley. We talk about so many films, so many genres. Right now, we are a bit on a superhero kick, it's because they're popular and people are watching them. And if people weren't, then they wouldn't be impacting culture. If they weren't impacting culture, we probably wouldn't be talking about them. So with that said, we're so grateful for you guys, for Tony, for Aaron, for being on the show. So please follow them on social media. Follow what they're doing around the web. Send prayers out to Tony finishing grad school. So meanwhile, you guys who have listened, we're thankful for you. I'm so grateful to know that you've taken time to make us part of your week. And until next time, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
So what you're saying is Bryan Singer's not an atheist.
It's nope. Plausible.
It is plausible, though. So, he was Jewish, so it's basically the same thing.
So are you saying...
So is Christ.
Oh, Tony.
Boom!
So is Magneto.
Maybe. Yeah. Culturally. Who knows?
Yeah.